Blog Talk Radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Movie Addict Headquarters with your host, Betty Jo Tucker, author of Confessions of a Movie Addict, right here at www.blogtalkradio.com.
Hi, all you movie fans out there. This is Betty Jo Tucker, thanking you for tuning in to Movie Addict Headquarters. We have a wonderful show for you today, folks, because we're replaying a fascinating interview with actress Katharine Houghton, the niece of legendary film star Katharine Hepburn, in honor of Hepburn's 105th birthday celebration this month. During this revealing interview, Houghton shares her candid reactions about her famous aunt's private life, and because she portrayed Hepburn's daughter in Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, Houghton also talks about that poignant experience. Among Houghton's other films are Kinsey, Ethan Frome, The Last Airbender, and Billy Bathgate. She's also a successful playwright, popular lecturer, and award-winning stage actress who made her Broadway debut in 1965 in Ruth Gordon's A Very Rich Woman, and won an Obie Award in 1969 for her performance in Scent of Flowers. In addition, she's played roles in over 50 regional theater productions, and as a playwright, her credits include a one-woman show about Louisa May Alcott, plus the plays Best Kept Secret, Buddha, and Bookends, a musical. Yay! Now, after the taped interview, which James Colt Harrison and I conducted, we hope to hear from Nancy Lombardo of Blog Talk Radio's Comedy Concepts, who will share her reactions, hopefully, and impressions about Katharine Hepburn's remarkable acting career. But first, I want to tell everyone that the chat is open, and I see that T.L. Walker is already signed up for the chat, and we hope he will be joined by other listeners, because after all, the chat is where it's at, and we really do appreciate the contributions of our chatters. Now, let's hear from Katharine Houghton. After a few delightful get-acquainted minutes, James and I finally decided to get down to business in this interview, beginning with some important questions about Katharine Hepburn and Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, which was a landmark movie, as you'll appreciate after hearing this interview. And here's the way that conversation went down. We should get on with the interview. And
fine.
I don't want to keep you all morning, but I'm just so glad that we do have you here. And I thought that James might like to start out with the first couple of questions. So, James, you're on.
I'm on. Okay. Well, let's see.
He's always on, though. Okay. But you're on.
Well, I guess the obvious question would be, how did Katharine Hepburn influence your acting career?
Well, you know, James, what I would like to talk about first is Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, since that is the role that I'm best known for in the world. Very often people say to me, you know, what did that mean for your career? And I think that is one of your questions, actually. And it's a very hard question to ask, because I think an actor who appears in a film that's had such popularity and notoriety over the years, you're really the last person to know exactly what effect it's had on you. But in answering this question many, many times, I think that there are three main aspects in trying to answer it. And the most important one is that for me it was a great life experience. That's the most important thing about it. A great honor, a great life experience, and I think the most important thing to me as a person more than fame and fortune is having great life experiences, because I do feel we come this way once, and to have wonderful life-changing experiences is a great piece of good fortune. Now, the reason I say it was a great life experience for me is I was part of creating such an important and worthwhile fable. I think of Guess Who's Coming to Dinner really as a fable. It's not realistic. It's a fairy tale.
Yes.
A fairy tale for the screen. And aside from all the wonderful other people in the film, who are always a great pleasure to see, the story is a very important story and continues to be a very important story, alas, which is that judging people for the quality of their soul is more important than judging them for the color of their skin or some other superficial quality. And I think we have to keep telling that story again and again, since we never seem to learn the lesson it teaches. But I think as a very young person starting out in the business, I'd only done a few plays and a few really amateur kind of films. This was, as a person, this was a tremendously important thing to me to be part of, because it was so high quality.
Yeah.
And it really made it very difficult for me to do films that I didn't, for some reason or another. Some perhaps would say, "But why the hell did you do that film?" But there was always a reason behind what I did, not just making money, but trying to do something that I felt had some importance to its content. The second thing was that it was very helpful to me as a theater actress to appear in that film, because it was such a huge hit. And naturally, theater producers who are concerned about box office like to cast what they consider names in order to sell tickets. So it opened up lots and lots of theater opportunities for me. And I was very, very lucky to be able to play many, many of the great classic roles, whether it was Chekhov or Ibsen or Shakespeare or Tennessee Williams or Eugene O'Neill or whoever. And I don't know that I would have had that opportunity in the theater without that film. And third and least important, doing that role in that film was very problematic for me as a young film actress, because it was my first big movie role. And Joey Drayton, as I'm sure you would agree, wasn't really a character. She was an idea. And
I hadn't thought of it that way.
As an actress, you can't reveal who you are playing an idea. And my primary job was to play the idea. It had nothing to do with my personality. I certainly believed in the idea with all my heart and soul, but I couldn't really be a personality. You know, I couldn't be my personality.
Yes.
So I think that Hollywood just didn't really know what to do with me. And if I'd started out playing in a more contemporary kind of film where I did play a character going through a divorce, or a character who was a single parent, or issues that were issues at the time, a woman who was fighting for some kind of career post, being the 60s and the 70s, the whole women's lib thing. You know, I could have been more of who I am as a person. But as I say, compared to the other two aspects of doing that film, that's really very unimportant.
Yeah.
And I really have no regrets, of course, about doing it. It was a great honor, a great thrill, and I am so amazed and pleased that the film has continued to be so popular.
Well, it's got such a great
following and such a social consciousness to it, as well as being entertaining and fantastic performances. You were awesome in that film.
Well, you're very kind.
Catherine, you were, and I was wondering, because so many things were happening there, you know, behind the scenes, I was wondering if you'd be willing to share us anything behind the scenes that was happening there between Katharine Hepburn and Spencer Tracy. We know that that was his last screen role. We know that that Katharine Hepburn won one of the two Oscars, and we know that the film is just stands out for all of us as a film that has meaning to it as well as entertainment value. So here we have someone who was actually there. So can you tell us anything that happened during the filming that you thought would be interesting to share with our listeners?
Well, it was a very stressful set because Spencer really was dying. And as a matter of fact, Sidney Poitier and I started the film up in San Francisco. It was the only location shooting that was done. And the first day we did the shots coming in from Hawaii at the airport and getting into the taxi cab and going to the art gallery. And when I got back to the hotel that evening, my aunt called me. She said the film has been canceled. And she said, and the reason is that Columbia Pictures cannot get insurance for Spencer. I said, okay, well, I'll get a plane reservation and come back tomorrow to L.A. And then she called later on and said, we've made a deal, and the film is going to go forward, so don't come back to L.A. And I said, well, what's the deal? And she said, well, Stanley Kramer and Spencer and I have agreed not to take any salary until the film is completed.
Oh, my gosh.
Mm-hmm. Some people think it was only my aunt and Spencer that agreed to that, but it was Stanley as well. That's how much they wanted to do the film. And so we went on, but every day was precious, and Spencer could only shoot a couple of hours a day because of his health, sometimes not at all. And needless to say, my aunt was under an enormous amount of pressure.
Oh, yeah.
And this was the love of her life, no matter what some of her biographers say. I was there. I know. I knew Spencer from the time I was a small child. He was part of our extended family. And she really saw that the end was coming, and it was terrifying and so sad. So, it wasn't a lot of fun, let's put it that way. Now, there were many, many other things that were going on the set, too. I think that Sidney Poitier, who had been recently attacked in the press for being an Uncle Tom and this and that and the other thing, was really seriously considering not doing any more films. And this was after he had done the wonderful film about Mr. Tibbs, James, help me here, In the Heat of the Night. And
right.
The film with Tony Curtis, The Defiant Ones, I think it was called, right, in this country.
Great
and on
film.
And on and on. He'd done so many brilliant films. And but the attacks that he was getting in the press were very disheartening to him. So I got to see what you might say backstage, him going through a very life-changing kind of examination of what he should do next. And he said primarily what he was thinking of doing was becoming a director. Now, he didn't quit acting altogether, obviously. I think he did To Sir with Love the following year and various other things. But I think if you look at his film resume, he didn't act as much as he probably could have after that. So that was a very dramatic thing that was going on backstage.
And well, is it true? Oh, I'm sorry. I just,
yeah,
before I forget this, I wanted to know if this is true, because you mentioned biography, and I just finished this the Charlotte Chandler biography, I Know Where I'm Going, which it's really quite an interesting read. But I think that she indicated that Katharine Hepburn has never watched Guess Who's Coming to Dinner because of how hard that movie was for her to make because of what Spencer Tracy was going through, and that she actually cried, you know, back on the set, I mean, during that last speech that Spencer Tracy made. Is there any truth to those things that were in that biography?
Well, of course she cried. I mean,
yeah.
She would have, wouldn't you, if it was your
yes.
great love that was dying and you knew that they were making the last speech in a film that they would ever make?
Absolutely.
I mean, how can people even imagine that she wouldn't be tremendously touched? She would have had to be a rock not to be touched. Everybody cried. It was.
And she deserved the Oscar for that movie, too. I mean, I thought...
Well,
was,
I don't think that it was her Oscar role, frankly, but I think that she and he deserved it together, and that's what she always said. She said, this Oscar is for me and Spencer and our life's work, and that's what it was for. And very often Oscars are consolation prizes or honoring you for something other than the role you're playing. She should have gotten it for playing Joe and Little Women and any other.
Yes, for sure.
Yeah, any other number of parts that were really great acting roles. This wasn't a great role for her either. She also was playing an idea, but she was already such an established personality that she brought that to the role, and the role was written for her by William Rose. But of course, she was genuinely moved, but everybody was. The whole set was crying. I was sitting there watching them, and everybody was crying. So I don't think that's such a startling revelation.
Well, I didn't mean to interrupt James. I know he has a few more questions, definitely, that he would like to ask. So James, I apologize. Go ahead.
No. It's fascinating to listen to Katharine because she's one of the better interviews I've ever been involved in because many
Me
stars,
too.
Yeah, you know, many stars don't have a lot of interesting things to say, but you certainly do, Katharine, and we appreciate that.
You're very kind, Jim. James.
Going back, I think the movie you were referring to, Sidney Poitier, was Call Me Mr. Tibbs, about the school teacher in England. That was the film you were referring to previously.
Call Me Mr. Tibbs, I believe, is a line from In the Heat of the Night that he did with Rod Steiger when a cheeky Southern officer says, hey, boy, do this, and he says to him, call me Mr. Tibbs.
Yeah.
Right?
I think you're right.
With Love, I think, was the film he did with the kids in the rough school.
I think you're right. Oh, my goodness.
Am I right?
Wrong. Yeah, I think I'm wrong, and you're right.
As it should be.
Oh, no, believe me, my film history is very spotty.
Well, I guess mine is spottier.
Just happened to know that one. Just happened to luck out on that one.
That's right. Well,
I did have a question. And despite all the tension on the set and everything for all the other actors, what was your biggest challenge when you were filming Guess Who's Coming to Dinner? Because it was one of your earliest films and you weren't well-versed in Hollywood and all that.
Oh, I certainly wasn't. James, I was really too young to be terrified. I think if another 5 years had gone by, I probably would have been frozen with horror at having to work with all those people. But except for Sidney, whom I didn't know before the film, of the three major stars, I knew the other two, and I knew them personally. So
yeah. Yeah.
It was like making a home movie. In that sense, you know, I wasn't acting with Bette Davis and Cary Grant or something. I was acting with two people whom I knew as Aunt Kat and Uncle Spence. And Sidney, who was coming in, well, he writes about it in his book, but there's some very funny moments on the set, because he was old enough and wise enough to know that this at that time was big theater history. And I didn't have any concept of that at the time. And he was very nice to me. He treated me like a kid sister, and he knew I'd been a philosophy major at Sarah Lawrence College, and he was very amused by that, and we talked a lot about philosophy and politics, and he just couldn't have been kinder. So I felt very at home with him. I didn't feel, he didn't do some sort of star trip on me and make me feel awkward. I felt very confident with him. And with Isabel Sanford and Cecil Calloway, they were just all nice people.
Yeah.
So, and they were all very aware of what was happening with Spencer and Kate, and Spencer's slipping away. And I think that they knew that there was a lot of tension, therefore, in my personal life. So they bent over backward. And the makeup people and the hair people, all those people were very, very kind. So for me, it was a question of survival, but not in the usual way that a young person coming into a Hollywood film. It was really just, okay, this is a really difficult situation because Spencer is extremely ill, and we don't know whether he's going to live from day to day, so I just have to really be on my toes and do my part as best I can, because we're in a crisis situation here. And also, I was very aware, and Stanley talks a lot about this in his interviews, that Columbia Pictures thought this was going to be an awful film.
Yeah.
They had no confidence in it. They thought it was going to do horrible business at the box office, and that the story was much too controversial for America, and on and on and on. So there was tension everywhere.
Well, there were still, that's back in 1967, there were still something like 14 states where racial intermarriage was banned.
Oh, you're right.
Was illegal.
The following year, Martin Luther King was assassinated. The following year, Bobby Kennedy was assassinated, for his attacks on organized crime. It was a very, very politically explosive period of our history.
Yeah, it was definitely, and this, I understand that the Columbia Pictures, I guess they didn't even want to open it in the South.
No.
And then I think it was just as successful, eventually, it was just as successful in the South. And I've heard that opening night, there were just crowds around the theater waiting to see the movie. That must have been given you and your aunt and Spencer and the director and Sidney Poitier some satisfaction that there were so many people who were interested in this film.
Well, I don't know about Sidney, because I don't remember ever saying, what were you surprised at the success of the film? But certainly Kate and I were surprised because of what we had been through at Columbia, with them feeling that this was going to be an extremely unpopular film.
Well, I'm so glad that they were wrong, and it's going to continue to be popular. And, you know, Catherine, you were doing this tribute next Tuesday to your aunt, and you're the only person that I know who knew her as an actress, you know, working with her in this film, and as a person. So I'm really eager to know what your most cherished memory is of Katharine Hepburn.
I don't know that I have a most cherished memory. I knew her for a long time and have lots and lots of memories of her. I don't know that there's one that I cherish in that way. She was a very complicated human being, not an easy person to be with. She was very powerful and strong and gave the appearance of being tremendously self-confident, but in her private life, she was actually terribly shy and arranged her life so that she was very protected. And oh. I think it was observations about her like that that were of particular interest to me, that somebody mm-hmm. whose persona was so powerful and confident and fascinating to people that people assumed that's really who she was all the time. And she wasn't. And that made for a very interesting study of a human being. And it intrigued me to see the different faces of her persona being one thing like a mask, and then who she really was underneath all that in the family.
I see. So quite different. In the biography I was mentioning, Chandler says that your aunt referred to herself as an actress as the creature.
Yes. She talked about that in many interviews. She called that persona thing I'm talking about the creature. I suppose in thinking about it right now that some of the best things about my aunt that I remember was her kindness to older people. And there were several people in her life, like a doctor named Dana Atkins, I believe that's right, who was a very famous doctor when she was a young woman up at the Columbia Presbyterian Hospital. And I even think one of the pavilions up there is Atchley, Dana Atchley, that was his name. The Atchley Pavilion is named after him, or for him, in honor of him. And when he was very old and couldn't read anymore, we would all go out to New Jersey where he lived and around lunchtime and bring lunch, and then she would read to him the newspaper or something, medical journal that he wanted to hear about, and little acts of really great acts of kindness that a lot of people wouldn't bother with in her position. However, that was her inner secret person. Mm-hmm. She felt more at home being with a man like Dana Atchley, who reminded her of her dad and the world that she grew up in. That made her feel as though she were home, and she felt comfortable doing that.
I see.
And then her husband, Ogden Ludlow Smith, they resumed a friendship after Spencer died, and he also was not in terrific health. And Kate would go up, Phyllis, you know who Phyllis Wilborn was, her
mm-hmm.
English secretary, companion.
Yes.
And Nora would make a great lunch. Nora Moore, Considine, would make a great lunch and would pack it in picnic baskets and drive it up to Connecticut, where Luddy lived. And again, you know, she would say, all right, now we're doing this. And she'd bustle around and she'd say, there are too many cats in this house, and one thing or another. But basically, it was all very dear, and she felt needed. And, of course, he loved it. I mean, here was the love of his life who had left him, divorced him in a rather peremptory fashion, and then coming back into his life in his old age and giving him such pleasure and such fun, and we always had a great time. That's who she was in her personal life. She was personally tremendously generous. And I suppose that's maybe what I cherish most about her.
Well, that is definitely something to cherish. And I agree with James, Catherine. You are a terrific person to interview. But I can't believe that we're running out of time. And I wanted to make sure that you had a chance to talk about what you're up to now.
I'm doing something that could be rather provocative and interesting, and that is we're opening in a play by Tennessee Williams called The Pretty Trap, which he wrote around 1940 before he wrote The Glass Menagerie. And it's either going to infuriate people or fascinate people because it's a completely different take on Amanda and Laura and Tom and Jim, the four characters that ended up being in the Glass Menagerie. It's a comedy, which is right away very different from The Glass Menagerie.
Yeah, for sure. Definitely, I didn't laugh once any time I watched that.
And second of all of the characters are very different. Maybe Jim, the most like the gentleman caller in what ended up being The Glass Menagerie, but the Amanda and the Laura. I have no proof of this, but I suspect that the Amanda and the Laura in this play, The Pretty Trap, which will open on 42nd Street at the Acorn Theater, I think around the 5th of August, I have a feeling that these ladies might be closer to his mother and his sister than what ended up being in The Glass Menagerie. And I have to say I've never had any interest in playing Amanda. I've played Laura twice, but I always found Amanda rather disagreeable and annoying. Mm. But this Amanda is an admirable. James, you will be very interested because this is a Southern woman who is a survivor, and is not nostalgic about the past. She has a great sense of humor, great practicality, and her object in life at this point that the play opens is to get this daughter married because she sees that she's not interested in having any kind of career. And the gentleman caller comes, and all I'm going to tell you is it ends happily.
Oh
my gosh.
You can see why
I'm
saying.
I can hardly wait to see it. That sounds so great. Well, I just am so impressed with all the things that you've done. I mean, I know besides Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, you've had over 15 other movies and TV roles. And then you've also become a playwright, a very successful playwright. And you do lectures. I can see why. I mean, you are so articulate. And we just don't have time to cover all of this. But we'll have to have you back on the show when we can spend the whole show just talking about your philosophy and your experiences.
That's interesting. Thank you very much, Betty Jo and Danielle and James. It's been a great pleasure for me to speak with you.
Oh, it's been great
fun. We have loved every minute of it. Thank you for being so candid and so informative. And we'll look forward to seeing The Pretty Trap and also to having you back on the show. So bye for now.
Bye for now.
And I think I muted myself, so I'm sorry about that. I just wanted to let you know, if you didn't hear this, that Catherine Houghton received glowing reviews for her work in The Pretty Trap. And I've been thanking the people in the chat, Comedy Concepts, T.L. Walker, and Cal Pote, saying I had so much fun in the chat. And I forgot to unmute myself. I was having so much fun. Now, I also want to thank my Facebook friends who sent me their picks for their favorite Hepburn movies. Marilyn Ferdinand picked Holiday, Love Among the Ruins. That was a TV movie that she made with Laurence Olivier. And Summertime. Deb Hockenberry picked The African Queen and Bringing Up Baby. Catherine Long chose Pat and Mike, and guess who's coming to dinner? Denise Cassino likes The Philadelphia Story and On Golden Pond, and Donna Hill picked Holiday and The Philadelphia Story and Desk Set. So those are some excellent choices, and thank you very much for your contributions. Now, I think Nancy Lombardo is in the green room ready to be brought out onto the stage, so I'm going to say hi to her right now. Hi, Nancy.
Oh, hi, Betty Jo, you old poop, you.
Oh, my gosh, you sound exactly like Catherine Hepburn.
The calanines are in bloom again. What a strange and wonderful flower. How strange that the flowers that graced my wedding day should be with me now.
That is just great. Nancy, you know, because Catherine Hepburn's voice is so distinct, it just wouldn't be right to have a show about her and not have somebody on who could do justice to her voice, which you certainly do. I always would try. Whenever I would see a Katharine Hepburn movie, I would, you know, pick out a line that I thought was just great from the movie, and then I would practice trying to sound like Katharine Hepburn, but I couldn't, you know, I just couldn't do it. So thank you so much.
She had a lot of great lines. My favorite all-time movie, Philadelphia Story is good, but just all around, the female cast of Stage Door.
Yes. Well, that was a great one because that had, it had Katharine Hepburn. It had Ginger Rogers.
Oh, they had some
Ann
great
Miller.
Banter. And it was mostly improvised. She
That's
showed up
right.
on the set,
That's
and then he said, no, I want it improvised. She goes, I need a script. Because nowhere. We want the lines to be natural and improvised. And I love the line Ginger Rogers takes out a fur out of Katharine Hepburn's luggage, and she goes, fresh kill? And she goes, shot it myself this morning.
That was good. I think that was good. But, you know, this Katharine Hepburn, she was so great in comedy or drama, you know, and anything in between. And one of the roles that I really just loved her in was as Eleanor of Aquitaine.
I loved Eleanor of Aquitaine, The Lion in the Winter.
Yeah,
what would you have me do? Give up? Give out? Give in? I love that.
Well, here she is playing the queen there, who's trying to sort of manipulate
Eleanor.
And she's trying to manipulate Henry II, played by Peter O'Toole, and you know, they're trying to decide which son, you know, to pick to be his heir, and you know, it's very, very complicated, and there's all kinds of intrigue, political intrigue, and that one line that she says is, what family doesn't have its ups and downs?
What family doesn't have its ups and downs? But I like what she said. Of course we have knives. It's 11:38. We all have knives.
She had so many wonderful lines in movies. And I guess I wasted quite a bit of time when I thought I was talking and I had muted myself. So.
And now we'll take a moment
of
silence.
Sorry.
Catherine Hepburn.
I'm so sorry about that, but I want to tell everybody to check out your terrific blog talk radio show, Comedy Concepts, and your CD that's just absolutely hilarious.
Color Me Crazy, available on CD
Color
Baby.
Color Me Crazy. That's exactly right. I want everybody to do that. And I just want to thank you so much for your support and for coming.
I got more lines. I love this one, too, on Golden Pond. Come here, Norman, hurry up. The loons, they're welcoming us back.
Well, yes, on Golden Pond, she did win an Oscar for On Golden Pond. Well, she actually won for Morning Glory, The Lion in Winter, Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, and On Golden Pond.
And this is an actress who got horrible reviews. Didn't Dorothy Parker write about her on Broadway when she played Coco? Catherine Hepburn ran the gamut of emotions from A to B.
Yes, from A to B. And she was dubbed box office poison there for a while. She was one of the actresses listed for box office poison, but you got to give her credit. She would buy up these properties, these plays, and she had the rights for them,
yeah.
You know.
And you know what? A little known trivia fact, Schubert Alley, she would park her car there so she could bolt out of the theater and head back to Connecticut. So she was one of the few people who was allowed to park their car there.
She really, I don't know, she knew where she was going, what she wanted to do, and she pretty much didn't let anything stand in her way. And she's given us so many wonderful films and performances to appreciate and enjoy. She died on at the age of 96 on June 29th, 2003, and her birthday is May 12th, 1907.
Wow.
So there are some celebrations going on this month for her 105th birthday, and I'm very honored to have been lucky enough to have you and Catherine Houghton on the show today to help celebrate Catherine Houghton's 105th birthday.
Nancy Lombardo?
Yes, Nancy Lombardo. Well, I'm just... I'm so sorry that we don't have more time, but I do want to thank you and Catherine Houghton and James Gold Harrison and Danny Dyer and Nikki Starr for all their help. And I want to thank the folks at Blog Talk Radio for picking this particular episode to feature as one of today's staff picks. I want to be sure and mention that. And since we are running out of time, I want to remind everyone to check out our film reviews at realtalkreviews.com. That's R-E-E-L, realtalkreviews.com. And to come back next week for a discussion with Jesse Baguet, who's an independent filmmaker. He's going to talk about his movie, his new comedy, Cellmates, about a Ku Klux Klansman and a Mexican laborer sharing the same cell. And I think that'll be a great episode, so don't miss it. Now, because Katharine Hepburn once summed up her personal philosophy with this advice, listen to the song of life. Here's Gene Kelly to close the show by helping us do just that.
I'm singing in the rain, you're singing in the rain, what a glorious feeling. And I'm happy again. I'm laughing at clouds dark up above. The sun's in my heart and I'm ready for love. Let the stormy clouds chase everyone from the place. Come on with the rain, I've a smile on my face. I walk down the lane with a happy refrain, just singing, singing in the rain. Dancing in the rain, yeah, 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 yeah. I'm happy again. I'm singing and dancing in. I'm dancing singing in